From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Good Tuesday afternoon to you. I'm Sarah Perry, your host on this, the 21st of July, 2020. Coming up on today's edition of Washington Watch, Portland, Oregon has always been known for its uniqueness, but it is now fast becoming known for its lawlessness. In response to widespread violence and rioting, the Trump administration dispatched federal troops to regain control, indicating it might do the same in other cities like Chicago, where violence and destruction continues apace. House Democrats voiced alarm at the crackdown, but has the administration overstepped its authority or acted appropriately? I'll have a conversation with FRC Senior Fellow for Human Rights and Constitutional Governance, Ken Blackwell, about what potentially happens next. In my second block, I've got David Clausen, FRC's Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview at the Family Research Council, on Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden's attempt to woo a new type of voter typically committed to Trump, the evangelical. I'll continue our discussion with David at the bottom of the hour, discussing new data out from the Pew Research Center on how important God is or isn't in the lives of everyday Americans. And in my last block, national uncertainty about American education has given rise to a new phenomenon, the pandemic pod. It's a phenomenon I found myself actually investigating for my own children before I discovered it even had a name. I'll be joined by Lindsay Burke, director of the Center for Education Policy, and the Will Skillman Fellow in Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation on how pandemic pods are fundamentally reshaping K through 12 education in America. A reminder, and you've heard them before, but TonyPerkins.com is today's podcast website. Go there for more information, links, resources, and articles about what we'll be discussing today. Follow us on social media on Twitter at FRCDC, at T Perkins, or at Sarah P. Perry, and be sure to follow FRC on Facebook as well. We carry live events there. Get the Stand Firm app if you haven't already downloaded it. It's available in your smartphone app store, and you can take the show with you wherever you go. Well, outrage, at least from the usual Democratic suspects, has greeted the use of federal personnel in Portland to enforce laws that the mayor of Portland and the governor of Oregon have refused themselves to enforce. But the presence of federal authorities seems to have escalated the violence in a city headed toward the two-month mark of rioting, looting, and arson. And joining me now to talk about it is FRC's Senior Fellow for Human Rights and Constitutional Governance, Ken Blackwell. Ken, I love talking to you. Welcome back.
Hey, Sarah. Good to be with you.
Okay, you are a former mayor yourself. You are watching cities devolve into chaos coast to coast. As a mayor, what is the ideal response to what you've been seeing in these cities like Portland?
The ideal response is for mayors and police chiefs at the local level to mobilize their forces to bring safety to the streets and neighborhoods of the cities that they lead. Look, Sarah, I think it's important. I read a paragraph in a piece of literature. I forget where it came from, but it talked about the unique confluence of events in our time, but that we had seen this in history before, perhaps in separate moments. And so it says something like, so far, 2020 has been quite a year. Started off like 1974, an impeachment crisis, quickly became 1918, a pandemic, turned right into the 1929 economic crash, and now has morphed into the 1968 urban conflict. The reality is that the confluence of these destructive, destabilizing events is such that it just cries out for leadership. And the rabid left is actively trying to rewrite American history as being inherently bad from the start. Therefore, our values, historical narrative, monuments, and anything that makes us uniquely American must be disparaged and destroyed. And our elected officials cannot stand on the sideline. And if they do, in American history, there are moments when life and property have been at risk and being destroyed, that higher levels of government have had to, in fact, secure the safety of our streets and our neighborhoods. Ideally, mayors and local officials, city council members, will own the challenge and meet it with effective leadership.
Yes.
When they abandon it, that means the next level of government, whether that's the governor, you know, or the president, has to mobilize forces, stay within the constraints of the Constitution, but get it done. And
yes,
I think this president is and the Attorney General are ready to do that.
Well, you know what? Speaking legally here, and Ken, you know this already, but for those who are listening, the Insurrection Act of 1807 authorizes the use of military force to restore order. And you include within that umbrella National Guard and active duty military units. And these individuals were not identified by particular branch, I'm assuming National Guard, but state governors are also empowered to deploy the Guard. He decided to do, rightly so, in your and my estimation, to deploy regular military forces during this period of heightened internal chaotic conflict, and other presidents have done it. President Eisenhower has done it.
Right.
President Kennedy did it. Now, of course, we won't hear that because it requires us to be intellectually honest, right? We don't want to admit the fact that previous presidents have also invoked the Insurrection Act, and rightly so. But the bringing in of federal troops really seems to elicit a vociferous and almost increasingly violent response. And in fact, there was a group of mothers who had organized and a group of fathers who had organized, all of whom were wearing yellow last night. And it seems to sort of up the ante. And yet, to that I say, until the mayor of Portland or the governor of Oregon decides to get their own houses in order, what we're watching is not only a destruction of property, but a loss of life. You've written about how this is sort of a continuing phenomenon and that these cities all bear one striking similarity. What is it you've written about there?
Well, look, The reality is that, Sarah, the left, the rabid left, as I call them, you know, they've tried to advance this false narrative that all of this is the result of systemic racism, and I think it's very important that we look at the facts and we look at the truth, and speak out. I don't attribute every major problem in urban areas or black communities to slavery or Jim Crow, and I don't believe racism remains a systemic problem in America. I do believe, as a person who has led a city and as an undersecretary at HUD, visited cities across this country, I do believe that as we watch from the late 60s with the Great Society program, when we watched the growth of the welfare state and destruction of the opportunity society, what we saw was a system of the welfare state that incentivized, you know, women to marry the government and men to abandon their financial and moral responsibility.
Yes.
That's the problem, the destruction of the family. The family is the incubator of liberty. And what we know about the Marxist activists and groups that are driving this destruction is that they don't believe in the family. And they believe they can chase God and faith out of the public square.
Yeah.
And so the question becomes, you know, what are we going to do as a people, as cities across the country are in ruin, and fear has taken place in many communities?
Well, and you've also said that, you know, the Democratic Party, who, ironically or not, perhaps in an anticipated fashion, has been in control of these particular cities and these particular states who seem to be having the most problems. And the AP just a few hours ago reported that President Trump is planning to deploy federal agents to Chicago, about 150 Homeland Security troops, because Lori Lightfoot, the mayor there in Chicago, refuses to do anything again about the violence, the destruction, the rioting, the looting within her own house. And so Donald Trump has said, it's time for me to bring in Homeland Security troops. You have written eloquently about the fact that the Democratic Party has been no friend to the African-American community. Can you elaborate on that?
Look, again, the real systemic and deadly reality in these major cities is that men and women of color are being slaughtered in these cities and communities in numbers that can only be compared to war zones in Iraq and Syria. And
yes,
every single one of these have been run by Democrats in some cases for as long as 40 years. And the issue here, again, as I said at the beginning, will we allow these people to run from accountability, or will we hold them responsible? And,
yes,
and when you see the mayor of Chicago basically saying that she's willing to let the slaughter continue,
mm-hmm,
and the reality is that 95% of these folks are being killed by other people of color, other,
yes,
blacks. And so she's basically saying that that's okay. You know, if in fact we can create enough chaos and enough fear that people will vote Donald Trump out of office. Well, I think she's going to be surprised.
Yes,
I think people are basically, I think people are basically going to say enough is enough. And you guys should be kicked out of office for dereliction of duty.
You know, we got about a minute left here, but I want to ask you a final question. Do you believe that this is still about George Floyd, what we're seeing in terms of the protests and the claims of systemic racism and the destruction of property and the fire and even the loss of life, which we've seen, for example, in Seattle's CHOP autonomous zone? Is it still about George Floyd?
No. This is about the left advancing a strategy to fundamentally change our country, and to affect this change, they first want to destroy it. As I said in the beginning, they in fact want to make sure that there is no positive interpretation of our historical narrative. That includes monuments and anything that makes us uniquely American.
So it makes you wonder, in these Democrat-run cities who are facing these issues like violent crime and murder, is it incompetence or is it intentional? Ken Blackwell has been my guest for this first segment. Stick around. I've got David Clawson, our Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview, on a new election tactic employed by Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden. Will he win the evangelical vote? We'll talk about that and more coming up next on Washington Watch. Stick around.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. Consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man wherever books are sold.
Absent fathers, distracted fathers, and angry fathers have created a vacuum of the soul in the lives of many children. Pornography is epidemic, affecting the male brain, isolating his heart, and degrading women who long to be cherished. Confusion and even skepticism about marriage run rampant, especially in our younger generations. Selfishness among men has led to broken homes and a trail littered with broken hearts, including their own. Where can you turn to find the solutions to these problems? Leadership and Love, A Tale of Two Fathers, is a new publication from Family Research Council that takes a look at two men, Joshua and the father of the prodigal son, as strong examples of leadership and love. It also weaves in an understanding of attachment science to underscore the needs of children, which need to be met to become emotionally healthy and spiritually strong. Visit frc.org/fathers to learn more.
In today's culture, it can be difficult for men to navigate what it means to be a man and to find clear models of masculinity and manhood. There are many competing ideas out there and even confusion around the basic concepts of gender and sex. Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join me at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate leaders who understand the issues of the day. These issues will invest in unpacking our role as defenders, providers, instructors, and battle buddies so that men can have generational influence as a chaplain inside and outside the home. Join us at one of our upcoming events in Texas, Louisiana, Florida, or Virginia. Learn more about Stand Courageous and find an event near you at StandCourageous.com. That's StandCourageous.com. StandCourageous.com.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry sitting in with you on this Tuesday, the 21st. And it's a hot one. I'm sure you're all steaming equally. We're in the midst of a heat wave. And again, we've got another hot topic here on Washington Watch. This is an already contentious election year. But the Democrats are using apparently a new tactic for their presumptive Democratic nominee in an effort to retake the White House. And that's religious faith. Now, they are betting on Joe Biden's apparent comfort with his own personal faith. He's talked about reclaiming the soul of the nation and how his personal faith informs what he does. So he's using particular buzzwords. They want to use that as a point of contrast with the president and are hoping by doing that to chip away at Trump's base by appealing to pockets of conservative evangelicals. So joining me now with some perspective is David Claussen, FRC's Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview. Welcome, David.
Great to be back with you, Sarah.
All right. So Biden has identified himself as a devout Catholic. This is according to his deputy political director. He said, "We have baked it into the core messaging and core functions of the campaign." OK, this is from his deputy political director. So this is not your average Joe off the street. This is an individual who was tasked with making Joe Biden saleable to the American public. They are baking faith messaging into the campaign. However, you and I want to distinguish between the difference between personal belief and policy promotion. Okay, that's a lot of P's, so I've relied on cheap alliteration there. But let's talk about that difference. So help us break that down a little bit.
Yeah, so it's a significant distinction and difference, Sarah, that we do need to be making. And not only is Joe Biden's campaign making that, they've recently actually hired somebody to oversee their faith engagement. This was in, a Wall Street Journal piece that came out a few days ago. And I think the comments that we're seeing, hiring someone to oversee their faith engagement, obviously Joe Biden's campaign is trying to avoid the mistake that Hillary Clinton made in 2016, which was to essentially ignore and demean evangelicals. However, no matter what Biden's team says about the candidate's shared worldview with voters for whom faith is important, it remains an objective, unambiguous fact that Joe Biden and the Democrat Party hold values and views on policy that are antithetical to biblical Christianity. So This is where we need to be very careful. We need to perceive, understand. We need to be Bereans, you know, the language of the New Testament. We need to really understand what's going on here. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to say that you stand with people of faith. It's another to endorse a platform that is odious to basic tenets of the Christian faith.
You know, I'm glad that you brought that up. That's such a – it's a wise interpretation of really what we're dealing with here. And to commend you, we really do need to be the Bereans who are sifting and weighing the information that they have here. I'm going to go back to what John McCarthy said, the deputy political director for Joe Biden. I'm going to sort of hoist him on his own petard here by using his own words against him. They have said – McCarthy has said, listen, they might disagree on a particular issue, Joe Biden and American voter X, but can connect with Biden through a shared worldview. Well, people vote, one would think, on issues. Issues drive individuals to the poll. I see a very distinct difference in the issues as presented to us between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. And as a quick side note for those listening, if you want a summation of what this president has done for communities of faith, for individuals like those who listen to Washington Watch and who are interested in how he will continue to protect the rights, the liberties of faithful Americans, go to frcaction.org/accomplishments, and you can see a very lengthy summation of what he's done since taking office in January of 2017. So let's talk a little bit about differences. Give me some issues and help me break them down, David.
Yeah, that's you're right, Sarah. And, you know, it's just, you know, the Biden campaign, this spokesperson can say whatever they want, but it really is just simply absurd to argue that Joe Biden's worldview is shared by evangelical Christians. Because the thing about it is that one's policy positions, those are an outworking of one's worldview. The worldview comes first. That's the foundation. And policy positions flow from the worldview. So what are Joe Biden's policy positions? What is he running on? Well, he's running on the Equality Act. He said that'll be his chief legislative priority in his first 100 days. That would codify sexual orientation, gender identity into civil rights law, severely undermining religious freedom for people of all faiths. Yes. He's campaigning to undo the Mexico City policy, which prohibits taxpayer money to fund overseas abortion. He's promised to make support for abortion a litmus test for his Supreme Court nominees. Mm-hmm. He's now against the Hyde Amendment after supporting it for 40 years of public life. On the LGBT issue, and you and I have talked about this, he's so extreme on these issues that he's campaigned saying that men who identify as women should have the right to use women's private spaces, such as bathrooms, locker rooms, and shelters. And one other thing, and this blew my mind, he said this last week, I think it was, that he would force the Little Sisters of the Poor to provide birth control and abortifacients as part of their health care against the contraception. Against the conscience of these nuns who want to just serve people in their community. So again, Joe Biden and his campaign can say that he shares the worldview of evangelical Christians, but the policies that he's putting forward, again, are just antithetical to just the basic tenets of the Christian faith.
I'm going to tell you, I do believe that the issue as concerns gender identity particularly will not play well with the suburban women that he is seeking to grab, because they have been sort of a fluctuating metric between both parties. They have been the reason that Donald Trump lost certain states that he was guaranteed to win in 2016 based on what we knew about the sort of metric that he was making up. We knew he would grab the Rust Belt states, but the suburban women in particular. I think the gender identity notion as concerns Joe Biden is not going to play well in his favor, and that is a demographic that both of them need. That would be people like me, not to toot my own horn, but I am a suburban woman. And coming up next, we've got more information. David and I are going to keep talking. We've got new Pew Research data that shows views on the connection or lack thereof between belief in God and morality. Stick around. We'll be right back on Washington Watch.
Do Christians have a biblical obligation to participate in government? Do Christians have a duty to vote? And if so, what principles should inform them while casting their ballots? How should pastors think about politics, and how can they shepherd their congregations well during an election season? The gospel of Jesus Christ has implications for all areas of our life, including politics. Christians must be prepared to grapple with the moral issues of our day, the reality of our two-party system, and follow our Christian convictions to their logical end by voting for candidates that support clear biblical values. Family Research Council has partnered with 21 state family policy councils for a new edition of Biblical Principles for Political Engagement. This booklet provides biblical wisdom and clear answers to pivotal questions to help you navigate the political landscape. This publication exists to facilitate careful thinking about issues and encourage God-honoring political engagement that filters all issues and candidates through a biblical worldview. To read the full publication, visit frc.org/engage.
Not so long ago, sex education in public schools involved learning about human growth and development and listening to advice on how to be careful, respect others, and save sex for marriage. Things are very different today. Parents have two main concerns about sex ed: that it sexualizes children and that it's loaded with LGBTQ indoctrination. Family Research Council has released a new resource to address this issue titled Sex Education in Public Schools: Sexualization of Children and LGBT Indoctrination. This resource reveals troubling examples of the agenda-driven content being pushed in modern sex ed and exposes the powerful organizations behind it all. Finally, it offers some action steps for parents to consider in their fight to protect the health and innocence of their children. For more information about sex education in public schools and to view this resource, visit frc.org/sexeducation. That's frc.org/sexeducation.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry. I've still got David Clausen, FRC's Director of Ethics and Biblical Worldview. And this time we're going to talk about new research out from Pew on a study they call the Global God's Divide. Now, this was people's thoughts on whether belief in God is necessary to be moral. And it varied by economic development, education, and age. So, David, help me analyze this study's results.
Yeah, so it's an interesting pulse area. You know, as an evangelical Christian myself, there were some things to take heart in, such as, you know, 72% of Americans saying that they do believe that God should play an important role in their life, 67% saying that prayer should play an important role. I think worldwide it actually said that 61% of people say that God does play an important role in their life. But beyond that, the thing that was troubling is that said that you, and this was a huge poll, it surveyed 38,000 people across 34 countries, six continents. But on the question of is belief in God necessary for morality and good values, only 45% believe that belief in God is necessary for one to have good values. And it's really interesting, especially in the Western countries. The poll just dropped. Only 15% of people in France think that they should believe in God to be moral people, 20% in Great Britain, 9% in Sweden. And for America, it was 44%. So it is a minority actually think that belief in God is necessary to be moral and have good values.
And there seemed to be a very strange connection also based on level of economic development. So we were seeing nations like Nigeria, South Africa, India, the Philippines with levels of correlation between God and morality into the upper 70s and in some cases even upper 90s. So that belief in God and that level of morality, that belief in a center of good and evil and right and wrong choices were inextricably linked. So it seems to me that there were some other variations here. We also know that there was a connection to education. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, almost ironically, in most European and North American countries that were surveyed, individuals with more education are less likely to say that belief in God is necessary to be moral, which is just really interesting because if you actually have a historical awareness, you'll quickly realize that Christianity has been the greatest source of good for the last 2,000 years. So that is actually kind of a part of the poll that sticks out as ironic to me.
I'm also very interested in the fact that education, we know, K through 12, and I'm going to talk about education in our next segment, it is fraught with quite a number of left-leaning atheist or humanist perspectives in education, and no more so than in higher education, where the notion of being both spiritual or religious or faith-filled and a deep thinker or an intellectual seem to be mutually exclusive. And so I think reinventing and recirculating that notion of needing to be intelligent and science predominating over morality kind of continues to drive that narrative. But we've gotten wonderful things from Christianity as a belief system. And to me, there is no differentiation between God and morality. God is the author of all moral and good things, is he not?
He is. No, absolutely. And that's what Christianity has taught for 2,000 years, that the very nature of morality, of goodness, of virtue is grounded in an understanding of the triune God of the Old and New Testament. And that's why I said earlier, Sarah, that I really believe, excuse me, that Christianity has been the greatest force for good in world history. And just think about some of the examples. These would include outlawing infanticide, child abandonment, the gladiatorial games in ancient Rome, ending the practice of human sacrifice among European cultures, banning pedophilia, polygamy, prohibiting the burning of widows in India. It was William Wilberforce, a committed Christian. He was the force behind the successful effort to abolish the slave trade in England.
Yes.
In the United States, two-thirds of abolitionists were Christian pastors. And even in the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King Jr., he was a Christian pastor who helped lead that movement against racial segregation and discrimination. So it's, you know, wherever you see social good taking place, wherever you see the fight for human rights, you're going to see Christians on the front line. And why is that? It's because it's the Christian worldview that tells us that all people, irregardless of race, skin color, socioeconomic background, all people are made in God's image and have value and dignity. And Christians have believed that for 2,000 years. And I think that's why you see Christians involved wherever you see human rights advancing.
I think there is something to be said, an argument there to be made, and you've just made it, that is a response to the individual who believes that even without God, they can be a good or a moral person. This is a continuing debate that I've had with friends who have no belief in God, who identify themselves as agnostics or atheists. I'm a moral person. I make good moral choices. Well, if your center is not the author of all good and moral things, the author of all truths eternal in the universe, you're not really centered by that belief. They may seem to be good, laudable choices based on how others respond, but they are not in and of themselves good choices. They're simply informed by other people around you, not by the author of all good things. David Clausen has been my guest in this segment of Washington Watch. Coming up next, we've got more on education, including a new phenomenon that even before I knew it had a name, I was already investigating. What is a pandemic pod? We'll talk to director of the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation, Lindsay Burke, about it right after this on Washington Watch. Stick around. Could you use some timely and original commentary to read this summer, specifically on the issues facing our culture today? FRCblog.com has just what you're looking for. The content on our blog is written by our policy experts, members of the Family Research Council team, as well as outside contributors. You can learn about religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture. Check out this list of a few of our most recent titles. What Does It Mean to Be a Woman? DC Christians Take to the Streets to Sing, Lament, and Pray, and Prayerfully Responding to Civil Unrest. At Family Research Council, our mission is to advance faith, family, and freedom in the culture by helping you to live out your faith and stand for truth. Our blog helps you do just that. Stay informed and get the resources you need at frcblog.com. On April 16th, President Trump and the White House Coronavirus Task Force announced a three-phase plan with guidelines for how states can begin scaling back restrictions. Churches should begin putting in place plans to reopen and operate their ministries according to the guidance of the Centers for Disease Control as state officials begin lifting orders. Here at Family Research Council, we have summarized the White House three-phase plan and how it relates to in-person church meetings and gatherings. Check out our resource, What Pastors Should Know About the White House Plan to Open Up America Again. Our resource offers practical guidelines for how churches and houses of worship can begin to operate safely as our country reopens. Visit frc.org/church guidelines to view this resource and learn more. There, you'll also find our full list of resources for churches in the time of coronavirus. Again, that's frc.org/church guidelines.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Hannah.
What's going on? Why so gloomy?
Well, I'm a little disappointed. I had a lot planned to do during the stay-at-home time, and I just didn't do it.
Oh, yeah? What did you have planned that you didn't get to do?
Well, I was actually hoping I would finally be able to get time to do a regular Bible reading routine, and I started a couple of times. I just didn't stick with it.
Don't be too down on yourself. Starting a new routine can be hard, but one way to help is to join in with others and to have a good game plan. I think I have a good solution for you.
Oh, yeah?
Tony Perkins and FRC are doing a 2-year study in the Word. They have it all mapped out.
When did they start? I would be so far behind.
Oh, that's not a problem. You can literally jump in anytime. There's a daily reading, just a couple of chapters a day, with questions to help you think about what you're reading.
Nice. Where can I find this?
Go to frc.org/Bible, and you can get started.
Where's that again?
frc.org/Bible.
Got it. Checking it out now.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in on this Friday. Oh, I wish it were Friday. Tuesday afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 21st of August, the year of our Lord, 2020. I get to talk about education, which is my favorite subject area. Of course, I have a personal interest with three in public school, but schools are still scrambling to come up with a semblance of a plan in an unanticipated and unprecedented period of American history. Coronavirus cases are still surging in certain parts of the U.S., and education decisions are now at the forefront of every parent's mind. There are no solutions coming to mind for any of us that seem automatically easy to incorporate. And even in my home state of Maryland, our county superintendent of schools has until August 14th to announce our children's plans in the fall, simply 3 weeks away, and we still have no answer on what the fall looks like. So I began to investigate something I did not even know had a name. Here to join me and discuss a new phenomenon is Lindsay Burke, who is the director of the Center for Education Policy and the Will Skillman Fellow in Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Lindsay, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much for having me back.
So this is a discussion about pandemic pods, which is something analogous, but not identical to microschooling. Can you talk a little bit about these phenomenons?
Yes, and like you, prior to this week, I don't think pandemic pods was really on my radar either. And it's amazing because it has just taken off over the past week or so. We are seeing families across the country, neighborhoods create spreadsheets that they are exchanging with neighbors in their region, where you can sign up for a pod, which is basically where families are working together within a neighborhood or social circle. They are sort of co-quarantining groups of kids in the neighborhood, and they don't have to be the same ages. And then they are basically paying out of pocket, contributing to a pool of resources and are hiring a teacher to teach these small groups of children in a pod. And so that is how they are pulling together as neighbors, as a small community, as a social circle, to make sure that their children in the neighborhood have educational consistency this fall.
Apparently, some of the bigger areas, and I read recently out of San Francisco, the formation of a Facebook group went from 1,000 members last week to now more than 8,000, most of whom joined within the past few days. I mean, the growth on this is explosive, but it makes logical sense. And I'm going to talk about sort of the equality aspect of this as far as financial differentials go in a second. But what I really want to do is first praise the American parent for the ingenuity of going, let's figure out what we can do. Some people are daunted at the prospect of full-time homeschooling. Some people like me need the benefit of IEP or 504 plans. And so we're hearing sort of the scuttlebutt about, okay, it's going to be virtual in the fall. Well, I can tell you, my youngest with a 504, it took everything, including a reappearance of Jesus in my room, to get him through that class before we could actually say, okay, we're sufficiently prepared for sixth grade. And that was daily one-on-one input. So what do you think, as someone who studies education, the feasibility and potential success is for this type of an educational model?
Well, I'm sure that Edmund Burke is smiling, seeing these little platoons come together. I mean, this is civil society in education in action in a way that we have really never seen before, at least in the modern era. And so it really just is a beautiful thing to watch develop across the country. And I would add, develop in response to school districts being closed in large measure because teachers' unions are really blocking their reopening this fall.
Yeah.
So there's some irony there. I mean, you look at Loudoun and Fairfax County in Northern Virginia just today said that they were going to go all virtual this fall. That's 260,000 kids. In Los Angeles and San Diego, they have said they're not reopening this fall. That's 700,000 kids. It's the nation's second largest school district. So hence the civil society response that we're seeing that I think, you know, you might really only see in America, which is really lovely to see. On the equity concern, you're right, and this is important. It is one thing to be a family who is in a neighborhood, can afford to pay out of pocket, to pool together resources, to hire and pay for a teacher to teach your pod. Not every family has that ability. This is why it is critical that education dollars follow children to education options of choice that are open and available to them. Measures like education savings accounts are critical right now, where families get a portion of the money that would have been spent on their child in their public school and can use that money to pay for private tutors and private teachers and online learning options. And so states need to really step up and step up quickly here to provide emergency education savings accounts to make sure that low-income children in particular aren't left out as we see this pandemic pod and micro school phenomenon move forward.
Right, right. And isn't it so funny? It does perfectly make the case for school choice and also indicates to the powers that be that if you don't give us school choice, we will exercise it anyway. And in this situation, it really is a, and I've called it this before, I want to continue to use this phrase, it's a transformative event in American education because it has allowed us to not only reassess what our kids are being taught. So we've got the element of being able to review sort of the ideology that's coming in through the public education funnel, but also to exercise different choices, whether that is deciding we're going to send our kids to private school, if we're going to take on homeschooling full time, if we're going to join a pod or a micro school, or if we're going to join a co-op. I have taken this as one of the rare silver linings of the entire pandemic, because it really has allowed me not only to spend more time with my kids, but really to reassess what they are getting for the American tax dollar. Some people have called for refunds of these tax dollars because, quite frankly, I'm not getting what my substantial taxes have promised to provide me. And these poor kids who are not able to, and I say poor sort of in an esoteric sense, because my heart breaks for them, the kids who are not able to pay for these other options, whether it's private school or a micro school or a pandemic pod, are really left with the singular option of having to do whatever the school department puts together, cobbles together as some form of education, and yet at the same time are often disadvantaged, and you know this, Lindsay, because they have not as much access to technology or technology that's not as good. So they really get it both coming and going.
Yeah, that's right. And you make an important distinction there that what we are seeing in terms of what school districts have been providing when it comes to online learning resources, that is very different and unfortunately has not always worked well from the district side, the district provision of online learning. It's very different than a family making a decision pre-pandemic to use online learning as their primary education source. I make the same distinction with homeschooling, too. It's very different pre-pandemic for a family who had consciously made the decision to homeschool versus what we're now seeing, which is the fact that we're all just accidental homeschoolers now and had it thrust upon us. And so I do think that's a really important distinction to make. But regardless, you are absolutely right. Families deserve a refund if their public schools are not going to reopen this fall or are doing it in such a way that it's just not meeting the needs of students. We spend about $15,000 on average per child per year across the country on K-12 education. Families should be able to take a portion of those dollars elsewhere if schools aren't going to reopen, and elsewhere would include things like pandemic pods and micro schools.
Yes, a way to use my tax dollars to pay an individual teacher who will give my son more individualized attention and not make sure that they are chock full of most of what comes through the public school system, many of which comes from a viewpoint or a perspective that I don't agree with. I want to go back to unions for a second because we're seeing so much talk about unions this year, not just in education. We're also hearing talk about police unions as well. But within the educational format, the NEA has proudly touted their endorsement of Joe Biden. And Joe Biden has said, and I'm using air quotes, I will be a teacher's first president. Well, again, as a mother, I say to you, wait a minute. I think American education exists for the benefit of American students, because that is your job, right? Is to actually make sure our students are being educated. To what do you owe sort of the outsized influence of unions here? Is this a health and safety concern? Is it an opportunity to collectively bargain for better paychecks? Is it pensions? Or is it a little bit of everything?
You know, I think it's a little bit of everything. And it is certainly in the interest of the union to continue to drive down class size, because that ultimately means that they need more teachers in the classroom and need more non-teaching staff, more administrators, which, of course, more administrators accrues to the bottom line of the union, because that means more dues-paying members. And so, you know, I do think that they see this as a moment to say we need social distancing to drive down class size before they're willing to reopen, for better or for worse, on the policy there. So I think that's playing into it. But I also think, quite frankly, that they see an opportunity that they can use in their minds to advance this liberal wish list. We saw it come out of Los Angeles this week with the teachers union there saying that they will not bless school reopening in Los Angeles until we defund the police, until charter schools are eliminated, until taxes are raised, and until we have Medicare for all. I mean, these are about as far away from the school safety with regard to reopening question as you could possibly get. And yet the unions in Los Angeles are using this as a bargaining chip during the pandemic. It's really just frustrating to see. And I know it's frustrating to the 700,000 students and families in that district.
You know, those sort of perfect wish list items from the teachers union sound a lot like what we were hearing from sort of the loose affiliation of individuals in the Seattle Autonomous Zone or Antifa or the Black Lives Matter organization, all of whom say we want A, B, C, and D before we'll leave you alone, to which the rest of America says, wait a minute, I think you've lost sight of the bigger picture here, what exactly this entire institution is supposed to be about. And as concerns American education does not have anything to do with Medicare. Can you please concern yourself first and foremost with the education of the children my tax dollars guarantee me an education for? I'm fascinated at the development when you mentioned really the ingenuity of these individuals who are coming together. It is exciting because it is a period of exciting development. But before we leave, I want to give you an opportunity to promote what you have upcoming. In just a few short days, you will have another Heritage Education event. You've done two of these previously. This is your third. Talk a little bit about that event.
That's right. Thank you. On Thursday, we have an event on how both families and school board members think about some of the really pressing issues in schools right now as they relate to sexual orientation and gender identity issues and life issues in schools. And so we commissioned a nationally representative survey of families and school board members to really gauge where they are on some of these pressing issues. So it's at 2 o'clock. It's a public webinar. You can find it on heritage.org. And we will be releasing all of our survey findings at that time.
I'm asking you to future cast a little bit, knowing what you know about education and about the fact that most students in America, it appears now, are going to be virtual in the fall. What do you anticipate for the future of American education? Is it going to get better or worse? And that's a big question, but I'm curious as to your perspective.
It is a big question, and we won't have the really hard data for probably 2 years to know what the actual academic impacts have been, particularly for low-income students, which, of course, is a concern here with the gaps that currently exist. So the raw data we won't have for a few years, but I will say that I am fairly confident in predicting that we will have a long-term permanent uptick in the number of families who homeschool and do virtual education. Just by way of comparison, about 3% of families across the country were homeschooling before the pandemic hit in March. So, you know, even if it went up to 6% that decided to homeschool permanently, that would double the number of families in America homeschooling. It would be a huge increase when you combine that with things like micro schools and these pandemic pods that we're seeing. I think we could see as much as 20% of the education landscape shift away from traditional schooling and toward this family-oriented model of education. And so that's what's really exciting. So I'm optimistic about how we're seeing the shakeup in the delivery of education. By the way, I think this will accrue to the benefit of teachers as well. Moving forward, we're already hearing that teachers who have been contacted by families to teach their pod are going to make more teaching a few families than they would have if their job as a full-time teacher salary the prior year. So it could really accrue to the benefit of teachers. And I think at the end of the day, it's going to mean more power for families to really direct their children's education. So hopefully that will be to the benefit. Hopefully we will see that in sort of the bottom line academic outcomes down the road. But it is something that we will certainly have our eye on over the next 2 years as the data come in.
Lindsay Burke, Director of the Center for Education Policy, and Will Skillman, Fellow in Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation. I always love talking to her. The upcoming event is part three of Heritage's Education in America, about gender identity and life issues in schools. May this be a period where you too have an opportunity to reassess your educational choices for your children and are reminded of the fact that as God's steward of them, the choice is yours. We'll see you tomorrow on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.